The Minnesota Court of Appeals is back in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Flory, Judge Smith, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, counsel. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is March 11, 2021. We are here for our second case on our oral calendar this morning. We're a little bit early. Are you expecting any clients, counsel, or are you ready to go?
No, Your Honor, I'm ready.
Ms. Navarette?
I'm expecting no one. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you. This matter is A190833 State versus Derschmidt. I hope I pronounced your client's name correctly. Counsel, I'm going to ask that you mute your microphone if you are not speaking. The marshal is showing a running clock of your time. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I'd ask that you identify yourself before you begin your argument because these proceedings are being recorded. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Eric Withall. I'm an attorney with the Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear before this court today representing the appellant in this matter, Christy Derschmidt. Today, we're asking this court to reverse Ms. Derschmidt's convictions for violating a harassment restraining order protecting her next door neighbor. And the reasons we're asking for reversal here concerns her due process right to not be convicted or sentenced for a crime while she's incompetent. And then the second issue is based on very similar reasons, that she has the right to effective assistance of counsel that involves the duty to investigate or move for a competency evaluation when there is reason to doubt her competency. Ms. Derschmidt made some expressions at trial that should have caused the court and counsel in the first instance to have reason to doubt her competency. She identified that she has been a targeted individual for over 20 years. She doesn't say 2001 is the commencement, she says 2001. Part of the targeting involves killing her pets, not owning a cell phone because she doesn't want to be further attacked by radiation, that her food was poisoned, and that she presented to defense counsel over 50 pages that they're microwaving her to death, resulting in sores all over her body from what they're doing. She submitted it to Mr. Soley, her defense attorney, but he felt it's not relevant. She also believes that her neighbor is involved in the targeting and is aware of her, whatever she is doing, because these microchips track her, and this results in her neighbor's ability to know when Ms. Derschmidt leaves the house and essentially entrap her into violating this harassment restraining order. The Rule 20 standard considers whether, as a result of a mental illness, the defendant is impaired in their ability to rationally consult with counsel or understand the proceedings. Courts have to consider several factors. I call them the drope factors, whether the defendant has presented any irrational behavior, their demeanor at trial, and prior medical opinions. This is a not exhaustive list. It's just kind of a guideline, a set of factors that the court should consider. And these statements that Ms. Derschmidt made at trial and at sentencing, these are pretty clear evidence of her irrational behavior, at least what was made part of the record at trial. We had a post-conviction hearing. We stayed this appeal to have a post-conviction hearing to further develop the record on what everybody else knew about that wasn't made part of the record. That included a YouTube channel that the prosecution had reviewed themselves and personally recommended to defense counsel. The contents of those YouTube videos is outlined extensively in a briefs and also in the post-conviction court's findings. In addition,
Mr. Whithall, I mean, I agree with you that your client is certainly experiencing some challenging circumstances. One of the things that I was searching for in the record, as you might imagine, is her inability or some evidence of her inability to understand the charges against her, to understand the role of everybody who's present in the courtroom, that she didn't understand her rights. She didn't understand, or she didn't have the ability to rationally consult with her counsel. And it seemed to me that she at least represented affirmatively to the district court that she understood everything that was going on, notwithstanding the other challenges that she's experiencing. Do you want to address that?
Yes. So first, her representations to the court about her understanding. The post-conviction court noted, and I'll give you a page in a footnote citation in there in the post-conviction court's findings, that they is page 7, and that's footnote 2. The post-conviction court addressed that, at least her statements about the roles of the parties, and that really more demonstrates her present ability at the time of the post-conviction hearing and shouldn't bear on her understanding of those roles at trial. But to go to the other factors that Your Honor has pointed out, like her capacity to understand the charges, defenses, and to consult with counsel, this quote at sentencing that she made really underscores the pervasiveness of her delusional beliefs in her capacity for understanding the charges themselves as well as the defenses. I do have proof that he, and that's her neighbor, is participating in. There's microchips in my body, so he knows exactly when I come out. I've got the proof, but Mr. Soli didn't submit it, and I gave it to him 2 months before our trial, and there's like hundreds and thousands of them. Ms. Derschmidt's delusions are so pervasive that she does not understand that the charges are the result of her alleged conduct. She believes that the charges are the result of her targeting and her neighbor's involvement in essentially entrapping her into violating this order. It's not that she refuses to acknowledge the role that she played in the criminal charges, is that she is incapable of understanding her role in the charges, that she believes that this is something that her neighbor and the government have concocted. As far as rationally consulting with her counsel and coming up with defenses, this is so substantially hampered by her fixation on this delusion that she is presenting her defense attorney with fake expert reports on both her capacity for reasoning her mental illness, but also this SCADA, S-C-A-D-A. I don't know what it is. It's this report that Mr. Soli testified that he received. It's what Pam Newman, her other defense attorney, swore in her affidavit that was attached to the post-conviction that she received. It's in the post-conviction court order's findings on page 5. It's S-C-A-D-A report describing the radiation and methodology for targeting and attacking her that Ms. Derschmidt relies on so substantially as part of her defense, to the exclusion of any other reasonable defenses that she can work with her attorney on. When her attorney says that I can keep her on track or redirect her, this goes to Ms. Derschmidt's behavior and ability to essentially get her to sit in her chair and be quiet during the proceedings. That does not bear on the ultimate conclusion, which requires her to understand the charges themselves, to understand the proceedings. So we're not saying that she's per se incompetent. We are lawyers. It makes us experts in the law, but we're not mental health professionals. We're not experts in diagnosing the impact of a mental illness on a person's capacity for reason, but only establish whether there is reason to doubt the relationship between those two things, the mental illness and their capacity for reason. That's a pretty low standard, reason to doubt. Any reason to doubt triggers the co-equal duty between the district court, the defense attorney, and the prosecutor under Rule 20. All of them have the duty, when there is reason to doubt, to move for the competency evaluation, to initiate the inquiry, the evaluation by a mental health professional, and to determine the ultimate question of what is she in fact competent? Because a court can't reach that conclusion without considering the opinion of a qualified mental health professional under Rule 201. It's the court's responsibility to reach that conclusion, but the court needs to be aided with that expert evaluation on the issue. And that's the problem in this case. When defense counsel is presented with these expressions of delusions, he recognizes them as a mental illness. He brands her with this label of a 19 and a half and testified at post-conviction hearing, at the post-conviction hearing, that he wasn't making fun of her when he said that at least 2 times, once individually to the prosecutor and a second time to the prosecutor and the judge in chambers, that he believes his client is a 19 and a half indicating, hey, it's pretty close to Rule 20. That to me signals that he A, recognized the that she's mentally ill, but also recognizes that there is some reason to doubt her competency by indicating this numerical value to the degree of her mental illness. And I'm trying not to say some of these other words that are used to label the mentally ill, but you know, ultimately it bears on the recognition when she's making these statements, when the defendant is making these statements that are undoubtedly delusional, when expressions of delusions are symptomatic of delusional disorders, the features of which directly bear on a defendant's capacity for reason. And I can direct this court to the APA brief, the amicus brief in Panetti, is really instructive on the unique features of delusional disorders on a defendant's capacity for reason. So if this court is looking for something, some way to parse out whether there's, you know, recognizing that I'd say probably the vast majority, the supermajority of defendants have some form of mental illness. It's the unique features of delusional disorders and the expressions of demonstrably untrue, bizarre delusions to defense counsel on the record during trial, at sentencing, in her YouTube channel that should have been reviewed by defense counsel because it was referred to him. She's suing the government for 20 years for airplanes flying over her head, targeting her. I mean, this is extensive, the degree and depth of her delusions. And because it is a feature of a delusional disorder that impacts her capacity for reason, this bears directly on the competency question, triggering the court and defense counsel's and prosecutor's obligation to conduct further inquiry.
So Mr. Withall, I have a question. In listening to your argument here and in reviewing the briefs, is your argument and the issues that you've raised here, the due process and ineffective representation, limited to the issue of the failure to pursue a competency evaluation under Rule 2001? And if so, I mean, the way you describe her mental illness, I'm curious as to why why there isn't an issue as to Rule 2002, whether there's a mental illness defense to these, and would that be incorporated in that evaluation? No one's really addressed it in the briefing, but if the mental illness is as pervasive as you argue, it kind of begs a question as to why that issue isn't raised.
The Rule 2002 issue is certainly relevant as a defense. That's something that defense counsel would have to raise at the time of the evaluation. That bears on essentially an affirmative defense to the actual criminal charges. A hurdle to raising.
But yeah, and I'm aware of that, but oftentimes those evaluations are ordered at the same time.
I agree. And they absolutely are. That's exactly where I was going with this. But again, they impact two different rights. An affirmative defense of Rule 2002 says it's essentially McNaughton, right? It's the defendant couldn't understand the conduct that she was engaging in as necessary to actually form the basis for committing the crime. And I think that there is a Rule 2002 defense there. I suppose we could have said that the attorney was further ineffective for not raising the Rule 2002, but it's grounded in the same premise of defense counsel's duty to investigate. This is the same duty that was triggered in Trevino. It's an unpublished case, but it's highly relevant when defense counsel believes the client is mentally ill, is aware of factors consistent with the Drope factors for competency, and then essentially does nothing to do an additional investigation. So I think that Your Honor is making a good point that Rule 22 is also implicated here, but because it's more of an affirmative defense, we grounded this in the due process right to be competent sense, because it actually goes to the question of whether the conviction itself is valid. And if the court does remand for a new trial, defense counsel should also consider the impact of his client's mental illness on her capacity for reason in committing the, at least the charged conduct, and raise that in conjunction with Rule 2001. With my, Judge Fish? Oh, I saw you unmuted. With my remaining time, I'd reinforce that the remedy here is not extreme. It's not to dismiss the charges. It's to put Ms. Derschmidt in a situation where she can be evaluated by a qualified mental health professional to determine the relationship between her delusional mental illness and her capacity for reason, consistent with Rule 2001. And if she is competent, as announced in Robinson and Drope, the remedy is to have another trial. And if she's not competent, at least the procedural rules in the state of Minnesota and acknowledged in the post-conviction court order under Rule 2001, the remedy is to dismiss the charges and not have another trial if she's incompetent. So I'd ask this court to reverse the conviction and remand for a new trial.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel? All right, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel, anytime you're ready.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Carlotta Navarette, Assistant Lyon County Attorney, and I represent the respondent. The two issues before the court are whether the appellant was denied due process and whether there was ineffective assistance of counsel because a Rule 20 evaluation was not ordered. In response to the appellant, he talks about how she does have a delusional belief. However, under Rule 2001 Subdivision 2, having a delusional belief is not what triggers the request for a Rule 20 evaluation. It is whether she can rationally consult with her attorney and whether she can understand the proceedings or participate in the defense. And throughout all of the proceedings, Ms. Derschmidt, although she did have these beliefs, they did not interfere with her ability to rationally consult with her attorney. As Mr. Soley maintained throughout the post-conviction hearing, evidentiary hearing, he could have conversations with her about what was happening. She maintained her not guilty defense. It wasn't an affirmative defense for mental illness. She stated, I did not do what they're saying I did.
But counsel, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Judge.
I mean, one of the things that is troubling to me is there's an examination of Ms. Derschmidt at some length about whether she understands the role of the judge, she understood the charges, et cetera. And it was pretty limited in scope, the questioning. And then when she's examined further, she's asked about whether she believed that the judge was targeting her, or whether her attorney was targeting her. And she was expressing some concern that the individuals who are participating in the judicial system are part of this conspiracy that she believes. And I question whether that is an indication that she is unable to rationally understand or rationally participate in the proceedings, if she believes that as part of her condition that members of the judicial system, her own lawyer included, and the judge included, are part of this grand conspiracy. That's concerning to me.
That is one way to look at it. Another is that is actually a very commonly held belief among some defendants, that their attorney works for the state, therefore they are not actually defending them because they are an employee of the state, that all the counsel, all the police, all the judges are just out to get them and make them guilty. So
I don't disagree that that's a commonly held belief, but that's different than my lawyer's trying to kill me.
But I don't believe she actually stated my lawyer is trying to kill me. She just wasn't sure, if I recall correctly from her testimony, whether or not he would have been actively acting against her.
But this wasn't a general distrust of the system. This was there's a lens implanted in my eye that they're spying on me through. This is, there's microchips in my system. And following up on what Judge Frisch said, you know, she really couldn't come out and say that the judge and her lawyer weren't part of that.
I mean,
so that's my observation. And that's, you know, that's my concern about whether or not there was reason to doubt, because this isn't about whether she was competent or not. It's about whether the process or whether the proceedings were adequate to determine that. So that's kind of the lens that we have to look at this through.
And at the time this was occurring, as stated, there was a chambers conference. It was discussed that she would talk to Mr. Stolle about her beliefs as a targeted individual. They discussed whether or not that was an appropriate defense. He determined it was not as a trial strategy. However, you know, and she disagreed with him that that should have been presented to the court, but they were still able to talk about the actual facts of what happened. And she would maintain that I wasn't yelling at him. I wasn't taking pictures of him. They were able to talk about the actual facts of the case and what occurred. They were able to talk about how this would proceed. And so she was able to consult with her attorney, even if she disagreed with him. In it further, I mean, the court did consider her beliefs. It was considered by the state. It was discussed that she had no outburst. She was having no problems in court. There were no prior evaluations. There was nothing additional that would have demonstrated that she was having difficulty understanding the proceedings, the charges, or being able to speak for herself with her attorney. And so regarding the first issue, is there was no reason to doubt her competency based on the drop factors that she wasn't having these outbursts or these unusual behaviors in court. Yes, we were aware of what her beliefs were, but she was still able to lucidly participate in the hearing.
What do you think, counsel, is the objectively reasonable behavior that a lawyer has when confronted with a client like Mr. Schmidt, where she is consumed with this concept that she is being targeted by everyone surrounding her and all of the other details about that? What do you think, or what is the objectively reasonable representation in a circumstance like this?
I would think, I mean, my opinion would be that, can she talk to her attorney? Does she understand the proceedings? Is she able to participate? Is she demonstrating behaviors in the court that would trigger some further inference that there is additional mental health issues that she can't conduct herself in the courtroom?
When counsel testifies that throughout the proceedings, Mr. Schmidt is continuously resurrecting the concept of, I want to present as a defense the circumstances surrounding these delusions that she's having, that wouldn't be some trigger that he should be asking for an evaluation, a mental health evaluation?
Again,
just from an objectively reasonable standpoint.
From an objectively reasonable standard, I still think it is whether or not he can talk to her about what happened. I mean, One of the things she testified to was that, I mean, one of the cases was whether or not she was taking pictures. She was able to say, I was ordered not to take pictures of him. I was not taking pictures of him. I carry my camera because I am a photographer, but I was never taking pictures of him. She could provide details of what happened that day.
But you know, part of what happened, according to her, is this delusional situation, right? So I'm just wondering about when she's talking to her counsel about what happened, and the what happened part involves significantly concerning behavior, is that the objectively reasonable trigger for the lawyer to be, I need a Rule 20 here?
I still think it goes back to whether or not they can have these conversations. And Mr. Soley testified that he was able to talk to her rationally about what was happening. Yes, she was expressing her beliefs, which were different than what the victim stated happened. But again, it was whether or not he could have these conversations with her. And he stated that he could. Further going through with whether ineffective assistance of counsel would be raised, whether there would be a Rule 20 raised, a Rule 2002 evaluation, as Judge Flory brought up, is that when that is brought up before the court, oftentimes it's because the person, they don't understand what they did was wrong, because it is the McNaughton factors. Ms. Dershmit maintained the entire time that she was not guilty and that these things did not occur the way that the victim stated. She had her version, as defendants do, of what happened that day, and it became a credibility issue to the jury. Regarding the ineffective assistance of counsel, as I stated previously, Mr. Soley was able to rationally consult with his client. She could articulate to him that she understood the process, she understood the charges, she understood her rights during the pretrial. Again, it was evaluated whether or not she understood the plea offers that had been made, and she maintained her not guilty plea because she stated she understood what those offers were and that she was rejecting them because she did not commit this offense. Differences over trial strategy, and that's what this turned out to be, is not a basis for ineffective assistance of counsel. And looking at the second prong of Strickland, was counsel's deficient performance prejudice, did it prejudice her defense? This respondent maintains his performance was not deficient, but at that point, it's a question of whether the outcome would have been different. It's not a foregone conclusion that she would have been found incompetent. As stated in the post-conviction hearing testimony, she actually did have an evaluation by a mental health professional at Western Mental Health, and it was determined that she needed no further services, that she didn't, I mean, it was recommended that because it was a person crime that she could benefit from counseling, but those recommendations were not part of her probation. She wasn't ordered to get any more services or programming. She wasn't ordered to have a more in-depth psychological evaluation. You know, but proximate to this, she was actually evaluated after the fact by a medical professional who determined that, you know, she did not need additional services or evaluations. So in looking at the reason to doubt, or excuse me, in looking at whether the outcome would have been different on the second prong of Strickland, it's likely that it would not have been, and she should not have been subjected to an intrusive evaluation for Rule 20 when all of the information available was that she could consult with her attorney, she could understand the proceedings. It was just that she was found guilty because the jury chose to believe the victim and not the defendant. Unless the court has any additional questions, I do not have anything further. Thank you.
Counsel, or I'm sorry, my colleagues. Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Whithall. Just wait 1 second while we get the clock going. All right, go ahead. Anytime you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't have any additional points to make other than to emphasize that a intake evaluation for mental health services is very different than the nature, extent, and scope of a Rule 20 evaluation on the issue of competence to stand trial. And again, that the report's not part of the record for the court to review, but my understanding of the nature and extent of the report is that it did not evaluate her competency, and essentially is irrelevant to the issue. But unless the court has any other questions that would be helpful to the analysis, I would ask the court to reverse Mr. Schmidt's conviction to initiate the appropriate Rule 20 proceedings.
Any other questions? All right, thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the 90-day period.